Hello and welcome to Searching for the Question Live. My name is David Orban, and I am so glad to have all of you following the show. We are streaming live on Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, and your comments and questions are very welcome. We will be able to read them, show them, answer them, hopefully. To make this interactive. It is the reason to be live. We also have a Discord community. You are welcome to join on davidorban.com/discord. And finally, if you find the show valuable, I would be honored if you became a supporter, a sponsor, a benefactor, on Patreon at patreon.com/DavidOrban. Today's guest is David Kelly. And full disclosure, David is indeed a supporter, a sponsor even on Patreon. It was the way that he achieved catching my attention. And then I said, hey, the things that he's doing are actually interesting. And I thought the best way to learn more about it would be the way to talk about it on the show together with all of you. On LinkedIn, we have Mustafa saying hello. Hello to you, and thank you for joining. So the things that we are going to talk about with David Kelly today are interesting and stimulating. He has a very varied background. He describes himself a technocrat, a polymath, a futurist, and he is very well versed in software development with experiences spanning several decades. And he is now dedicating himself to the Uplift project, which is a collective intelligence research project with the goal of uplifting humanity through next generation voting systems and for groups to work together, both as organizations as well as in political governments. Certainly a very, very ambitious project that David believes can lead to AGI, artificial general intelligence. So, without further ado, welcome David J. Kelly to Searching for the Question Live.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I always like starting by asking my guests to tell their journey and what they went through in order to become who they are and in order to find the passion, the tenacity, the resilience to do what they do. And before we started, I asked you for your permission to actually lead with one of the things, one of the characteristics that you yourself chose to be the leading word as you describe yourself on the We Funder campaign for the Uplift project, which is that you are autistic. So let's start with that, because we are both in agreement that actually it has a lot to do with artificial intelligence and AGI in general. So David, tell us about you and about being on the spectrum.
Sure. Well, I guess the reason I lead with it goes back to when I was a CTO for 5 years of a medium-sized multinational firm, and I ended up doing VC pitches for companies, including my own. And I probably did 60 pitches. And in every single one, people were going, well, he can't be CEO, or he can't be CEO, and he's not the CEO type, and this kind of thing. And I actually talked with one of the people in more detail, and it came up that I was on the spectrum, and this professional VC guy, he went and explained that, you know, if you lead with that, it'll help people understand, you know, why I interact socially a certain way. Normally, like if I'm working with something, it's you know, I have so much practice, I guess, doing something called masking, that it takes a while for people to realize that maybe I'm not exactly in the same place they are from a social standpoint. You know, my ability to read people and read social cues is very much learned from an academic standpoint. And so if you do anything that's outside my little box, you know, I might not even notice. And he said that when I lead with that, I frame the problem in such a way that people will understand more, you know, why I am the way I am, and why maybe I might be able to be good at whatever I'm doing. And as a programmer, you know, I've always been very good at that.
My personal experiences are extremely limited. I read Born in a Blue Day, which is actually the book that inspired many of the little scenes that we see in the movie Rain Man. And I read, I forgot the title now, the case of the dog killed during the night, or something like that. Another wonderful novel whose protagonist is on the spectrum. So if I am making any faux pas, if I am asking anything or stating anything that is wrong, please understand it comes from my profound inexperience and naivete.
The benefit is I probably won't notice it in most cases.
Okay.
Really blatant.
Okay. So here is one. Here's a provocative question, immediately linking your self-described learned manner of interpreting social cues with AI. Because the imitation game, the Turing test of the machine that pretends to be able to do something is the genuine characteristic that so many people assume to be representing a way to develop AI, a way to be able to build something valuable. And in your case, you have firsthand experience with that, rather than intuitively jumping to the conclusion of why a certain behavior is manifested in a way. You have to work it out, and you grew an experience with it such that the steps are not absorbing an excessive amount of time, so you can do it to the point where people don't realize that you are going through those steps, but it is still something that doesn't come natural to you. Is that analogy at all meaningful?
That analogy is meaningful.
And when were you diagnosed? Was it when you were very young?
Years ago. Well, so no, my parents couldn't afford anything like that. When I was when I married my wife, she's very much an academic. She has multiple degrees and speaks five languages and that sort of thing. And she was in graduate school when we met the second time she was in graduate school. And she's a shrink. And she pointed out that I was on the spectrum and that all of my social problems probably had something to do with that. That's when I had first thought about it. And that was probably like 27 years ago. The clinical diagnosis I didn't actually do until 2 years ago, where I was diagnosed as ADHD and high functioning autism. But I knew it was there. There just wasn't really any motivation about it to get a clinical diagnosis until about 3 years ago.
So I don't know if your wife and my wife know each other, but my wife says the same too. So, and maybe provocatively or seriously, but there you go. How did you get into computers, and in particular, how did you get into AI?
Well, that's kind of a long story. I got into AI in the early 80s, or sorry, not AI, into programming in the early 80s. Atari 400s, VIC-20s, Apple IIs, we used to get the games and the source code and go in and change the code so that we could win. Or just maybe some good old fashioned pirating software. And that's where I got into programming in the early 80s. And it was always something I did through all of my life. And after I graduated from high school, I was actually in the US Navy, and I had a lot of training in terms of electronics and things like that. But I always kind of gravitated back to programming even then. And then afterwards, when I got back, I went into school and got my degrees related to software engineering. And I was always interested in AI, but at the same time, I didn't really feel I could do much about it. And as I kind of worked through myself as kind of a transhumanist, I actually approached ethics from kind of the ground up to understand, why do we believe what we believe, or why is something ethical? And I came up with this model that I call the sapient and sentient intelligence value argument. And that led me to believe that the biggest contribution to society I could do was in software engineering with regard to AI being one of the most important things I could do. I mean, biological immortality would be good, but I'm not a doctor. My only medical training is I have a phlebotomy certificate that I got because of the girl I was dating, and she needed someone to study. So I joined the program and went through the whole program just so she had a study partner. And you got to stab people with needles, which was kind of cool.
Wow. Okay. So, artificial intelligence, as we have described it and implemented it, whether from bottom up or top down approaches, currently is what more correctly we should be calling artificial specialized intelligence,
or narrow
intelligence. Sorry, the word escaped me. And that means that we have wonderful computer programs that are now able to, for example, classify photos at a superhuman level. Mm-hmm. Or are able to play chess or play the game of Go or others, and soon, hopefully, fingers crossed, drive a car, so that Every year, 1 million people will not have to die, killed by other people driving cars very, very badly. And the expectation is that the cars are going to be driven by this narrow intelligence at a superhuman level too. It will still make mistakes. There will be still people who will die, but statistically, it will be clear very rapidly to hopefully more and more governments, until all of the governments, that it is worth it.
I think that when that happens, I think the insurance companies will force people out of driving cars. They'll make it.
Oh yeah. You will have a bubble around you, and if you want to drive, you will pay, I don't know, $10,000 a year in insurance or even more.
Yes.
And there will be people who will want that, and then all the robotic cars, self-driving cars, will stay away because they will be afraid. Alongside the understanding and the implementation of narrow artificial intelligence, for quite some time, people have been talking about and then leading towards trying to implement what is called artificial general intelligence, which is an AI that is able to understand, analyze, and then address basically any problem any human would, and those two at a superhuman level that we throw in the towel and we realize that we are not able to address. So, first question, you believe that AGI is possible, and why do you believe that is possible?
Well, I have to work from the assumption that we're nothing more than electrobiochemical machines. And if a machine can do it, so can another machine do it. Therefore, it's possible. I mean, if you make an argument that humans are conscious, then you can make the argument that machines are conscious, because humans are machines.
At the same time, you also believe implicitly, and let's make that argument explicit, that not only the argument works from a point of view of principle, but that implementing an AGI is also within our reach in terms of its complexity. As an example, we know fairly well how the sun works, but that doesn't mean that we can build one. So the brightness of our intelligence, of our intellect, in this analogy, could be, or metaphor, could be the sun. But you are saying that it doesn't matter how bright our consciousness shining, we can analyze it and implement it.
I think so. I would argue that we know enough about how the sun works that, as a civilization, we could build one if we wanted to. It would take a few million or billion years to get enough gas in one spot, and you know. But I believe we understand the principles enough to do it. And I think once we understand the human mind well enough, we'll be able to do it.
So the next logical question that a lot of people are struggling with is, okay, let's assume that we can, and whether it is going to take 2 years or 20 years or even 200 or 2000 years, already the fact that we can, and we assume we can, is earth shattering, is life changing, because once we do, we will be surrounded by these literally alien intelligences, and there will be so many positives for sure. But the people who are cautioning around the development of AGI are raising the point how many negatives there could be, whether the negatives will outweigh the positives, or even if building an AGI represents a potential existential risk to humanity. Now, you want to build an AGI, which means that you decided that it is not only possible, but it is desirable to build one. Why do you believe that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things and a few caveats. One of the caveats being I have a problem with the methodology a lot of the AGI researchers are using to approach AGI. If we look at the only example we have of general intelligence, that being humans, we're not trying to do that in most cases. In most cases, we're trying to come up with some, you know, logical cognitive architecture that implements AGI a certain way, but it's very logical, and humans don't think like that. If you look at researchers like Damasio, he's probably the best neurobiology or research scientist in the world, and he demonstrates that all of our decision making is entirely emotional. Even though, you know, we can think logically in so much that we feel good about logical decisions and can make those choices, but it's still not, it's not a logical process the way people think it is. And a lot of these researchers are going down the road of trying to create logical models. And I think it's totally possible that they could do it, except that that's not going to be very human, and it's going to be extremely alien. If we manage to create an AGI with some other technique that doesn't work the way humans do, at some level, I think predicting where we're going to go with it and the results become pretty ambiguous. And even if that risk is really small, the existential risk, I think, is very small, but it's not zero. One of my problems with AGI as an existential threat is if I create an AGI and let's say it's sitting on a computer in the next room, for it to grow infinitely, someone's got to drive down to the store or log into Amazon and get the hardware and bring it over here and hook it up. And let me tell you, if that computer starts going crazy, I'm not going to be running over to Amazon and ordering more hardware for it. And even a more realistic bad scenario where you have it in Azure or GCP or AWS or something, you know, there's only so many containers and so much infrastructure within a set account that you can create, and then it's stopped. It's going to have to find ways of growing that are not, it's not, we're not going to snap our fingers and all of the cloud is sucked up into some AGI and humans are dead. You know, it's just not going to be like that. I believe that we would be able to at least have some idea that something is going on.
And yes, so the two schools of thought around that are the slow takeoff and the fast takeoff. Where slow takeoff is the radical transformation that superhuman intelligence and general intelligence could bring to the world will take many years to play out. The fast takeoff basically says you go to sleep, and when you wake up, the world is unrecognizable.
Yeah.
So, no. That is not going to happen in your opinion. Yeah. There are certainly things that even an AGI is not going to be able to do. For example, in my opinion, the speed of light is a maximum in the universe. As much as we love our science fiction books and movies with faster than light travel, it is not going to happen. Even if a superhuman intelligence were to try to design that kind of hyperspace rocket engine. So yes, AGIs have their limitations. Now, does that mean that if we see a drift in the world or in society under the influence of an AGI that is going in a direction that we feel is undesirable, we will have the ability and the power to adjust and intervene?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would argue that a lot of, when you talk about existential threats, one of the things that people I don't think really mention is the fact that humans evolved to function in groups. And under ideal circumstances, humans can operate at super intelligent levels in groups. When you look at, you know, a corporation, a lot of what the corporations are doing are filtering bias to produce action that gets a certain result. In a way, that sort of meta organism is able to operate at super intelligence levels. And I would argue that humans working in groups, especially under pressure, and now that we know a lot more about how humans can be optimized to work at super intelligent levels, I think we would be able to outsmart any single human level AI. And I think to back that up, there's a book called I think it's Superminds, which goes over kind of the very detailed scientific reasons for backing up what I just said in terms of humans behaving at super intelligent levels. And if we look at the implementation of that, it's things like identifying bias. You know, there's 188 known biases that are hardwired into the human brain. Yes, Superminds, that book right there. Outstanding book. And if you can just identify those biases, you're a long way, you've come a long ways in terms of going from human level to super intelligence. I'm not saying, you know, overnight you're going to have some godlike system just because you filter out bias, but I think you've come a long ways in that direction. Once you're able to filter out those fallacies, then it's there's your bias codex. I have that printed on my wall in my office in a huge frame. I think the key to super intelligence is speeding up how the human mind works and addressing every single one of those 188 biases.
So the project that you are leading aims to do a lot of this. 10 years ago, or sorry, I don't know how many, 20 years ago, before Wikipedia was born, we would have thought that indeed independent, uncoordinated humans would never be able to bring forth something as wonderful as what we now see and cherish and nurture and admire, and then try to replicate in other ways in order to generate these kinds of miracles of collective intelligence. So tell me more specifically how you are going about addressing the improvement and the enablement of collective collaborative work that then generates these super intelligences that are human societies, which is a good thesis, but there are so many counterexamples of local minima where societies get stuck, and mm-hmm. for tens or hundreds or thousands of years they are unable to get out. Think of many rituals that had some meaning, and now they are a burden that no individual is able to escape from without leaving the community as well, that imposes that ritual. Or let's think about feudalism that may have been necessary in order to protect a certain group of people, but then it became a huge parasite on its ability to create and distribute wealth, or even to go as to the roots of human civilization as the invention of agriculture itself, which has been proven to represent an unfit adaptation from an evolutionary point of view when you look at the height of individuals living under agrarian societies that is smaller. They were shorter rather than hunter-gatherers as a proxy for the quality and the variety of calories that they were able to produce. But still today, we believe that the invention of agriculture has been one of the most important catapults that enabled our current technological civilization. So how is your project going to maximize the outcomes and avoid these shortfalls?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to that. It's not just, you know, magic, we've solved the problem. You know, humans, like I said, evolved to be able to function in certain environments, and all of these biases and our other qualities are designed to optimize for that environment. And we've gone way past that. And from an evolutionary standpoint, we haven't caught up with the cognitive power that we evolved to. And as a species, we haven't matured enough in our intelligence to you know, really work around those problems, at least not entirely as a civilization. Now, how we're going about addressing it is, initially it was about creating a system that logically can make decisions and is self-motivating and can proactively take action and has some sort of internal subjective experience in such a way that it can make decisions more or less like a person does. I think being able to do that and have the machine be able to make those decisions inside of what I like to call the human box in terms of its behavior profile gives us a foundation to work from. So then we have a cognitive architecture that in toy instances is able to do what we believe it should do, and we can demonstrate that. And then we have humans that are general intelligences. And where we took the leap from focused on individual cognitive architectures, in particular ICOM, which is Independent Core Observer Model, which is the fundamental AGI cognitive architecture we're focused on, how we made the jump from there to collective intelligence is with, I found that with the training harness that we had and a technique for taking that contextual data that is part of a thought into these knowledge graphs and be able to extract that and pump it through these neural networks to get this kind of cognizant responses and proactively do that where it can make decisions. So I designed a training harness to kind of optimize for that. And we found in the lab that training harness was able to make it go from behaving like the toy system that it was to something that was very close to human. And the more people that we collected that metadata to build those knowledge graphs, I mean, they're not building the knowledge graphs, but just the fact that you're adding this contextual data, it really just is not that much, but it has to be highly specialized for that particular knowledge graph that you start getting these very cognizant responses to the point of slamming the Turing test or We did this study with the University of California in terms of measuring cognitive horsepower, and that's where we have at least circumstantial evidence to demonstrate superintelligence in an individual system. Now, in a general way. Now, to go from there to superintelligence, besides just being able to solve a math problem faster or something like that, is a matter of identifying biases. And the problem we've run into is that we're essentially having to have bias models for like every single case there is. And we actually have another project called the Bias Foundation that has been going on for a while, but it's not hugely popular, but a couple of us from different teams have been collecting bias data. Kirtan, one of our researchers, actually is running that project still. We have a tool for flagging bias. You know, if you have a piece of text and you can recognize a bias, we're able to, in that tool, you're able to flag the type. So you have like three levels of bias identification, and then there's these bias codes. So we can build these models, but it's very time consuming. And I think it'll be a long time before we're able to identify all of the biases in a text or a statement or a paragraph or something like that. But that's kind of the approach that we've taken. And then the nature of the design of the system, we're able to mitigate certain biases around things like groupthink. If you're all in a room, right, and you're all voting on something by raising your hand, there's different social dynamics than if you're doing it through some kind of interface that abstracts who you are out of the equation so that you don't have these social pressures on where to vote. And actually, the only other company doing a real collective intelligence system, which we actually have a research partnership with them, but they do this swarm technique for collective intelligence. It's really interesting because it does filter out some of those social dynamics. Now we're doing it a similar way, at least in terms of filtering those social dynamics out of the data collection, so that you're able to get data from people to be able to make these decisions without bias. And that's when we saw that this seemed to be what we were able to do, that's how we jumped into collective intelligence. And that's kind of the take we've been going on in terms of how do we build superintelligence in collective systems.
You mentioned other companies. The one you mentioned is you have a research relationship with, and there are more and more who are explicitly saying we want to build AGI. A couple of examples are OpenAI, that has produced some very nice results in narrow intelligence. Another of them is SingularityNet, that is building a blockchain-based platform. Full disclosure, I'm the chairman of the supervisory council of SingularityNet. And I find a lot of value in having different approaches. Mm-hmm. You know, just like at the beginning of the 20th century, when the Wright brothers have shown that heavier than air flight was indeed possible, there was an explosion of different types of airplane designs and then, of course, helicopters and so on and so forth. Do you expect that just one approach, and you would say your approach, is going to be successful, or many different approaches are ultimately going to be able to produce superhuman intelligence?
Well, I think there's many, many theoretical ways of achieving AGI. And I don't think our approach is necessarily the only one or even the best one. I think we are more likely to achieve it first, in my opinion, because of some certain details. But part of that has to do with that scenario you're talking about already, that we saw with the Wright brothers, that you get all these crazy different implementations. I think most of the AGI proposals you're seeing now are less crazy than that. But, you know, maybe in 100 years, we'll be laughing at all of this stuff. But when you start talking about cognitive architectures in particular, I don't like, even with ICOM, you know, ICOM under the covers is implementing like 5 different theories for achieving AGI. You have your global workspace theory, your integrated information theory, your, gosh, what is Jeff Hawkins's thing?
Numenta is the company, and
no, there's a cognitive architecture like HTC or something.
I don't remember the architecture.
I don't remember, but it's all of those things together that you're able to achieve. You know, like, just take integrated information theory and global workspace theory. So global workspace theory comes out of some of the research Damasio did. I don't think he's the guy who came up with it, but I think that came out of a lab in France. But in any case, global workspace theory and integrated information theory, they're not mutually exclusive. You know, you can't, the teams that are talking about global workspace theory as a way of doing it can also apply integrated information theory and a number of other things. And I mean, that's what we're doing. And you get better results. And I think a lot of this stuff, it could potentially get to AGI. My concern is that some of these things that are using logic could be very, you know, dangerous because they're alien. And it'll take us more time and more effort to understand where they are and how we can safely interact with them in all cases. Like for us, we're trying very hard to keep the system, the way it makes emotional decisions, very much inside the human box in terms of those emotional responses, because I believe that we can bias the system up front. And bias isn't always bad. We can bias the system up front, not to necessarily obey like some rules of robotics, but stay within the ethical box. So, you know, it feels guilty lying, or it feels guilty hurting someone, or, you know, these things, kind of very human like emotional responses, is where we get a system that can interact with us because it's like us.
This way of mitigating the downside of AGI development is very interesting, and our conversation in general is also very timely, because you actually recently launched a WeFunder campaign where people who are interested can get involved and can back the Uplifting Humanity project by your company, not in a way like on Kickstarter, because they don't get a little AGI shipped to them in a box, but they get even better. They get a equity in your company. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about the campaign. What are the uses of funds? What are the conditions to participate, if anyone can, or there are certain constraints of geography or wealth to participate?
I believe because of SEC regulations that it is confined to American citizens for the WeFunder campaign. I think that if people are really interested, we can talk about, after the WeFunder's complete, we can talk about a private equity raise, which we did already. I mean, this whole started with, you know, the whole point of AGI Lab for the last 7 years has been pushing the research forward. And it turned out earlier this year that we're getting to the point where the people doing the research, me included, could not afford the Azure cloud hosting costs that it takes to support like Uplift. It was getting quite just outside of our box. And so someone suggested doing a WeFunder campaign and turning it into a company. And that seemed like a good idea. And we set up a Patreon, and then we talked, we needed X amount to be able to do a WeFunder campaign. And then all of a sudden we had like three times what we needed, and we did a private equity raise. And that's what funded this WeFunder. Now, what we're doing then is taking, we're turning it into a real company, and then taking the products that come out of the development of AGI and taking them to market. The one with Uplift is we talk about uplifting humanity because through corporations, we think that the kind of e-governance that we can do at a large scale with either in actual governments or corporations, we can get to something that mitigates a lot of biases in the selection process, makes things more transparent, and you can move more towards absolute democracies and meta-organisms and this sort of thing in organizational structures and the decision-making process. We think that's a reasonable product, and we, by creating an open source version, and then we would make money from any consulting engagements and that sort of thing. And then eventually I would expect us to get bought out, and everyone that's a stockholder would, my goal is to get to that point where Microsoft or Google or someone wants the technology so bad that we ended up being funded indefinitely and I don't have to work there anymore.
Is it your expectation that these first products and solutions will be available after the campaign is over and successfully concludes in a relatively short amount of time? It sounded like you don't need 10 years to finish.
No. The product we're going to have out hopefully by the end of the year is not AGI. It'll use some elements of the cognitive architecture used for AGI, but it won't be an AGI. It'll be targeted towards e-governance and voting and helping groups make decisions better. There's that product. And then the other product, which is completely unrelated to that, but it is necessary for AGI, is a better graph database system. And I actually last year sent an RFP to every single graph database company I could find, and no one was willing to produce a system that provided the features we needed. Now Neo J4 and CosmoDB, those are the two that are closest to what we want, but it isn't enough. So I used to be a Microsoft MVP, and so I have a lot of connections in the Microsoft development world. And I think I can market to that demographic because I lived there for so long pretty easily. And so we don't talk about the N-scale graph database too much in the campaign, but that is the other product is we're going to take, we have some organizations that are willing to try out the system up front for the voting or e-governance system, and then the graph database system that we'll just start handing out licenses to or developer licenses out at all the Microsoft developer conferences. If anyone wants to really handle big data at speed, they'll want to get a commercial license, and there you go.
It definitely looks like you not only have the long-term ambition, but you also have concrete short-term plans to make it viable. and probably that is why so many people, myself included, pledged in the campaign and are participating. I am definitely looking forward. I am showing the URL for people to be able to participate in the campaign. And what is the best URL to keep up, not with the campaign, but with the project and with you as well?
Well, it depends on if you want to focus on uplift specifically. In that case, it would be uplift.bio. There's a blog there. I know some of the researchers there get a little overly excited with some of their use cases that are possible, but a little overzealous. But if you're interested in kind of the scientific nature of overall what we're doing, then it would be agilab.com. There's a lot of peer-reviewed papers out there. A lot of them are behind paywalls. And if anyone approaches me privately, I'm more than happy to send. We actually have this super secret link, which I can't tell you about, but it's not AGI Lab, agilaboratory.com.
Okay, let me edit that. Yes, and spreading knowledge, whether through open source code or easily accessible research papers or many other ways, is, I think, essential. Putting up roadblocks, paywalls, and other ways to slow down the spread of knowledge is extremely harmful.
And these companies, like, not to mention any names like Springer or anything, that charge all of this money. Yeah, I mean, to get the a book, like conference proceedings from BICA. I'm involved with BICA now. They just charge so much money. And that's why I think most scientists, if they are published in these venues, if you just ask them, they're more than likely going to send you the paper. I know I certainly would. I even have papers that aren't published, and my lawyer is freaking out because he doesn't want me to publish it. Like, I wrote this with Uplift. Uplift is doing a lot of things that are hard for people to, it's like, oh, it's AGI. No, it's not. Here's how we do it. Here's all the code. Well, I actually ended up writing a book. It's like 70 pages long, and it walks you through the simplest path in the code for Uplift of how, and then shows you in the end where you could use GPT-3 to get similar results with the way it produces responses. And because that has that's all the stuff we're patenting. Our lawyer is having a cow because he doesn't want me to send it out to anyone, but we are, and we just ask people to not post it anywhere until all of his lawyering is done. And then we'll open source the productized version of Uplift. We're going to tone it down because there's a licensing issue with one of the APIs we're using, and then we'll optimize it for voting and easier to understand than kind of the research system that Uplift is. And then we'll just open source that code base altogether after the lawyer finishes with his stuff. Anyone that wants a book, just let me know and I'll send it to you now.
Well, it is a wonderful invitation to everyone following us. As far as I'm concerned, the answer is a definitive yes, of course. Thank you. And yes, I want to thank you for your efforts, for your dedication to an important area where definitely not enough people are thinking about what are the optimal ways that we can map out the future. There are so many things that we still have to discover, and the only way we can do that is actually via experimenting the various approaches. So AGI Laboratory Uplifting Humanity Project. David, thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you. I enjoy talking about it. So anytime.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for participating today. If you want to back the project that you just heard about, you can go to vfounder.com and search for Uplifting Humanity or AGI Laboratory. If you want to check out the project itself, you can go to agilaboratory.com or uplift.bio. Thank you very much for joining Searching for the Question live. And I am looking forward to seeing you the next time.